This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, July 7th, 2009. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda. Coming up in today's program, the deposed president of Honduras visits Washington as he drums up international support for his return to power. In Italy, the world's richest countries prepare for a G8 summit in an earthquake-stricken town. And civil liberties groups accuse the Obama administration of violating the U.S. Constitution. All these stories and more after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Chinese authorities imposed a curfew in the western region of Xinjiang after violence between ethnic groups continued today. Protests began anew when hundreds of mainly Uyghur women took to the streets of Urumqi and challenged riot police armed with water cannons. They demanded the release of family members detained after Sunday's riots. Many were taken during house-to-house arrests Monday night. By day's end today, as many as 10,000 mostly Han Chinese armed with makeshift weapons tried to storm the city's People's Square. Authorities blocked them from entering the mostly Uyghur area. Twitter and Facebook are both shut down in most parts of mainland China, and access to the internet has been blocked completely in much of Urumqi. The unrest follows ethnic riots Sunday that left 156 dead and nearly 1,500 arrested. In the UK, the British Police Department issued a heavily critical report on its own controversial handling of demonstrations during the G20 meeting in London earlier this year. It's called For Reform of the Policing of Protest. From London, Naomi Fowler.
Today's report says police should facilitate peaceful protest. They're failing in their human rights obligations and need retraining. Also, protesters should be warned if police are intending to trap or detain them in a designated area, and the tactics should be explained. The police received around 250 complaints about their tactics during this year's G20 summit. They detained thousands of demonstrators outside the Bank of England for hours with no access to food, water, toilets or medical assistance. One passerby died after an unprovoked attack by officers. The G20 protests were probably the most filmed and publicly disseminated demonstrations ever to have taken place in Britain. Chief Inspector Dennis O'Connor.
Some concerning images, which probably in the past might not have been seen by very many people, suddenly became available to everybody. And so they underlined the issue about public confidence and consent.
Campaigners worry that in future protests, those with recording equipment will be targeted by police. Naomi Fowler, FSRN, London.
Unpiloted American aircraft, or drones, dropped more bombs in Pakistan's South Waziristan tribal region today. At least 16 were killed in the bombing said to target a Taliban training compound. Today's drone attack follows two other such strikes on Friday that killed 13. According to the United Nations, fighting in Somalia has spread to areas that had not experienced violence before. Diane Bailey reports from the UN.
UNHCR says the escalating conflict in the Somali capital of Mogadishu is having a devastating impact on the city's population, causing suffering and massive displacement. The agency estimates that by Monday, the 8-week offensive led by the Al-Shabaab and Hizbul Islam militias against government forces had driven over 200,000 people from their homes. UNHCR spokesman Ron Redman says in the past week alone, more than 100 people have been killed and over 300 injured in the fighting that has spread to new areas.
Several neighborhoods have been affected, and these areas have hitherto been islands of peace in the chaotic city. They did previously escape much of the conflict and destruction, but many residents are now fleeing their homes for the first time since the start of the Somali War in 1991.
The United Nations Refugee Agency says there are now more than 1.2 million displaced people in Somalia. Diane Bailey, United Nations.
Minnesota finally has two U.S. senators again. Democrat Al Franken was sworn in today. Franken took the oath with his hand on a Bible that belonged to the late Minnesota Senator Paul Wellstone. Last week, the Minnesota Supreme Court ruled in Franken's favor in the electoral dispute. His opponent, Republican incumbent Norm Coleman, then conceded. The FDA issued new food safety rules today and announced a new post, that of Deputy Food Commissioner. The new rules include increased testing for salmonella bacteria in eggs and poultry, as well as E. coli contamination in beef. The administration also announced that by the end of the month, they will issue standards aimed at reducing E. coli in some produce as well. And there's good news today for hundreds of laid-off workers at a Chrysler plant in Illinois. The Belvedere facility will restart production, and they've been called back to work. The plant was idled in May when the company announced it would lay off nearly 1,000 workers by the end of this month. Chrysler spokesperson Max Gates says that plan is now being reassessed. Yesterday, the California State Attorney's Office unexpectedly dropped charges against four of the men known as the San Francisco Eight, former Black Panthers who critics say have been unjustly pursued. The state assistant attorney general said the charges were dismissed due to insufficient evidence. The men were charged with the 1971 killing of a San Francisco police officer and conspiracy. Charges have been dropped against five of the men so far. Critics say the case was based on confessions obtained through torture. Two other defendants have taken plea deals on lesser charges. Only one of the eight original defendants, Francisco Torres, remains charged in the case. He faces another preliminary hearing August 10th. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
The deposed Honduran president, Manuel Zelaya, arrived in Washington today to meet with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Unlike most Latin American and European countries, the U.S. still hasn't recalled their ambassador from Honduras, nor cut aid, which U.S. law requires in the case of a coup. However, President Obama today said that he supports Zelaya's return to power because the United States supports the principle that people should choose their own leaders, even if, quote, we don't agree with them. Zelaya has been met with more enthusiasm in Latin American countries with left-wing or socialist governments. On Monday, the ousted president was in Nicaragua. FSRN's Nan McCurdy reports.
The democratically elected president of Honduras, Manuel Zelaya, was in Managua Monday after his plane was not allowed to land in the capital of Honduras Sunday afternoon. The media found him leaving a parking garage after trying to buy a replacement cowboy hat for the one he left in Honduras when he was kidnapped and exiled on June 28th. They asked him if he would try to return to Honduras.
I'm not going to try. I'm going to return. You can be completely sure of that. An article of the Constitution says that no Honduran may be expatriated. I'm President of the Republic. I'm going to return. I'll return as the elected President of Honduras. I'm not going to say how or when, because then they'll prepare. But it could be any place, any municipality, any department. I'm going to begin going to Honduras and do what I've always done, public, democratic, and open assemblies so that people know that the efforts they are making are not in vain.
Zelaya invited OAS General Secretary Jose Miguel Insulza to accompany him to the meeting with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, scheduled for Tuesday in Washington, D.C. Zelaya has the full support of the Organization of American States and the United Nations, who recognize him as the only legitimate president of Honduras. Monday, a delegation from Michelete's de facto government went to Washington, but no one from the U.S. government or the OAS would meet with them. Sunday, while 200,000 Hondurans marched in hopes of welcoming President Zelaya back home, Michelete accused Nicaragua of moving troops toward Honduras and of border guards firing into Honduras. But Nicaraguan General Adolfo Cepeda disputed the charges.
That is not just false, it's absurd. The Nicaraguan army is an extremely disciplined institution, obedient to its command. Here that discipline has been maintained, and that's why I say that Micheletti's accusation is absurd.
President of the UN General Assembly, Miguel Descoto, was also in Managua after accompanying Zelaya on his attempt to return to Honduras. Descoto thinks Zelaya will return to the presidency in Honduras shortly.
I am optimistic that the operation return will conclude successfully very soon.
The OAS suspended Honduras from the organization Saturday after they failed to meet its 72-hour demand to return Zelaya to the presidency. All member organizations have recalled their ambassadors and suspended financial aid, except one, the United States. All the European nations pulled their diplomats out of Honduras, following the lead of most of the Western Hemisphere, except the United States. Last week, the World Bank and the International Development Bank suspended funding, and Friday, the Pentagon announced suspension of joint operations with the Honduran military. President Zelaya hopes to convince Secretary of State Clinton to recall the U.S. ambassador, cut off aid, and use her diplomatic weight to return him to the presidency. Nan McCurdy, FSRN, Managua.
And now we go to Honduras, where de facto President Roberto Micheletti called for negotiations with the deposed President Manuel Zelaya. Micheletti's supporters congregated in the Tegucigalpa city center today, calling the Organization of American States a pawn for Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. The OAS recently expelled Honduras from its ranks after the Central American country refused to allow the ousted President Zelaya to return to power. Political divisions are rising in Honduras, with at least two marches taking place early Tuesday. FSRN's Tim Russo reports.
As Xiomara Castro, Honduras's first lady, came out of hiding and prepared to head to a march Tuesday morning in support of her husband Manuel Zelaya, supporters of de facto President Roberto Micheletti began to gather in the city center to hold their first demonstration since Friday. The pro-Micheletti marches have been characterized as the white marches because of the white shirts that have been used to evoke a sense of peace. During Tuesday's pro-Micheletti march, demonstrators and speakers called the Organization of American States a tool for Venezuelan President Chavez's Bolivarian initiative.
Today, the OAS has stopped being an organization of the American states and has become an organization for the Alba Bolivarian project. We condemn the tyrant Hugo Chavez, who has become the largest distributor of cocaine in the Americas.
Anti-coup demonstrators have called the marches the white-collar, upper-class marches, claiming that only businessmen, their families, and workers under threat of job loss are participating. Today's rival marches have attracted a couple of thousand participants each, much less than Sunday's anti-coup demonstration. Yet the watchful eye of the police and military has been reportedly more intensely covering the anti-coup demonstration Tuesday morning. Monday, at a late afternoon press conference organized by the National Front Against the Coup, popular movement leaders discussed freedom of expression under Micheletti. Maria Ursula is with COFADE, a human rights organization. She said the national police have arbitrarily detained a large number of people during the daily curfews that continue to be imposed from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m.
In Tegucigalpa, we know of 318 detentions, in Santa Barbara, 65, and in San Pedro Sula, 180 people have been detained for curfew violations. From the demonstrations, there are 215 additional people detained. Obviously, we do not know of everyone. This is only the tip of the iceberg in relation to what is actually happening in Honduras.
Also on Monday, a message from the presidency was aired over all TV and radio stations, insisting that all people that received any public funds or materials to support or organize last Sunday's referendum need to return all materials and funds or become subject to federal investigations, sanctions, and possibly worse, insinuating detention. Carlos H. Reyes, leader of the drinks and similar workers industry in Tegucigalpa, announced that a general strike would be intensified in the face of Sunday's repression.
The strike continues and is intensifying. It has grown, and we're going to the demonstrations and other places where repression happens. There is repression, and there's already been assassinations.
Ousted President Manuel Zelaya vowed to return to Honduras, but declared that he would not reveal possible dates. Tuesday, the international airport in Tegucigalpa remained closed and under military control. Tim Russo, FSRN, Tegucigalpa.
The heads of state of the world's richest countries, the G8, are set to meet in the Italian town of Aquila on Wednesday. The Italian government initially planned to stage the meeting on a Mediterranean island, but it moved the summit to the mountainous Aquila. Prime Minister Berlusconi wanted to put the spotlight on survivors of the April earthquake that devastated parts of central Italy. However, Aquila's residents are discontent. They say resources are now going to the G8 meeting instead of the reconstruction of their town. FSR's Diletta Varlese reports.
The people of Aquila are preparing for the G8 meeting, remembering that 3 months ago an earthquake changed their lives. The residents organized a long torchlight procession to bring awareness to their plight as leaders of the 8 richest countries prepare to come to their city. It's 3:32 a.m., the hour when the earthquake hit the city. There is almost complete silence as 5,000 people march, remembering their 300 relatives who died in the earthquake. As the marchers enter the city center, a single person plays the trumpet as military helicopters fly overhead. The city has become more militarized as it prepares for the arrival of world leaders. Many in Aquila are not happy that the G8 meeting is in their city. They say they have been neglected since the earthquake left so many homeless. Residents say it took world leaders coming to their city to get people to pay attention.
We want to interrupt this media show that has been built around our city, that says everything is fine. It isn't fine.
Mattia Lolli is member of 332 Committee, a spontaneous group of young people that came together after the earthquake to protect the interests of residents.
The government wants to show that reconstruction is going well and fast. But what we see is that there's nothing happening yet. Our houses are still as devastated as they were months ago. We are still camping inside tents. That's never happened before from any other earthquake in Italy. The only construction we see are in preparation of the G8 summit.
There are people who have lost everything, their family, their house, all their belongings. Some stayed for months in the hospital and are now living in tents. Residents claim that €500,000 for reconstruction has been directed to welcome the G8. Federica Muggia is a survivor of the earthquake.
They're building a swimming pool, a golf course, and a basketball court for President Obama. I do believe this money was supposed to be spent for the city reconstruction. There's no other explanation for where it comes from.
Federica was found under debris after 7 hours with a collapsed lung and many parts of her body broken. Her father and sister were killed. She questions the government's response.
We were told a week before the earthquake that 20,000 body bags were ordered by the city hospitals. They knew it was going to happen, since we had been experiencing earthquakes since Christmas. I think there's been a lack of communication with the public, even though they had plenty of time to inform us before the crisis.
The Italian government has promised 15,000 new houses before September, but construction hasn't started yet. People are fearing a cold winter living in tents. Alessandro Bianchi is part of the 332 group that is proposing social policies to keep the city together.
We're trying to rebuild the social infrastructure, since all gathering points have been destroyed, like public squares and bars. We hope our community will want to share and build together a new vision for the future.
On Wednesday, G8 presidents will arrive in Rome. A few peaceful demonstrations have started in the capital, but police have already made more than 50 so-called preventative arrests to people who have participated in previous rallies. A rally is also planned in Aquila City. Diletta Varlese, FSRN, Rome, Italy.
Nearly 8 years after the U.S. captured the first detainees, the debate continues on what to do with them and how to try them. The Obama administration confirmed that some detainees will be held indefinitely, while others will be tried in a military commission. Civil liberties groups say the policy violates the U.S. Constitution. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
The Obama administration is moving forward with military commissions for Guantanamo Bay detainees. The special court system is administered by the Department of Defense. At a hearing on Capitol Hill, Senator Carl Levin, chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee, asked Assistant Attorney General David Criss if the process is sufficient.
Do you believe that it is appropriate for the Department of Defense to prosecute alleged terrorists with these military commissions instead of the Department of Justice doing all the prosecuting in Article III courts?
Article III courts are legal lingo for the U.S. civilian federal court system. Assistant AG David Criss responds.
I think the president made clear in his May 21st speech that we will prosecute in federal court, and where there is a law of war violation and under a reformed system of military commissions, we will also prosecute law of war violations in those commissions.
Military commissions provide less rights to the accused than civilian courts. Vice Admiral Bruce McDonald defends them.
We're relying upon our soldiers to go into a dangerous environment, and we're worried about their safety. They're worried about it. We don't want them to have to stop and think about giving Miranda rights. We don't want them thinking, in my personal opinion, about whether or not the statements that they are getting from someone in a house that they've just broken into, whether that statement is purely voluntary or not.
The Obama administration promises to reform military commissions by outlawing evidence obtained through torture and all forms of coercion, only accepting evidence obtained voluntarily. This is stronger than a proposal before the Senate, which would throw out evidence only obtained through torture. Of the 229 detainees remaining, the administration also says it has the right to hold them indefinitely. Also to be determined, which detainees will be ushered through military commissions and which will be given civilian trials. Republican Senator Mel Martinez of Florida asked when a civilian court will be used.
Who gets tried under Article 3, and who may get tried in MCA?
DOD General Counsel Jay Johnson said the framework must still be determined.
Where feasible, we would seek to prosecute detainees in Article 3 courts. We're working through now a variety of factors for our prosecution teams to consider in terms of what direction to go.
Civil liberties proponents call the military commissions unjust and alleges the government will use them to bypass legal requirements. Chris Anders is with the American Civil Liberties Union.
The president ends up shutting down Guantanamo, but still keeping the military commissions going and still holding people without charge. Then he hasn't fixed the problem of Guantanamo. He's just relocated to another zip code.
The administration says regardless of which system detainees are tried, they can appeal in civilian courts. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
Today, the U.S. Senate Environment and Public Works Committee held a hearing to look at developing new clean energy legislation that would mitigate the impact of global warming. Committee members heard from the heads of the EPA and the Departments of Energy, Agriculture, and the Interior. But the real tension came from the senators themselves, with Democrats accusing Republicans of being reluctant to move forward with clean energy, and Republicans accusing Democrats of favoring higher energy taxes and trumping up charges of climate change. FSRN's Karen Miller has more.
In her opening statement, Chair of the Committee, Democrat Barbara Boxer, anticipated fierce words of fear and doubt coming from Republicans. She was right. Republican Senator James Inhofe was disgruntled and offended.
You have stated that we're the party of no. Well, that's true. We say no to higher energy costs, no to subsidizing the East and West Coast at the expense of the Heartland, no to more bureaucracy and red tape, no to the largest tax increase in American history, and no to sending our manufacturing jobs to China and India.
This statement signifies a problem that the Senate will face in passing an energy bill. The committee is tasked with drafting legislation to reduce U.S. dependency on foreign oil, create green jobs, and cut greenhouse gases. However, Republican Senator Lamar Alexander hopes nuclear is part of the solution.
If we really want to deal with global warming, we really only have one option, and that is to double the number of nuclear power plants we have. There is no other technological way that we have to have a large amount of reliable, cheap electricity other than nuclear power. So if we're in the business of saying, yes, we can, if the president would give the same kind of aggressive interest to building 100 new nuclear power plants that he does to building windmills, we could solve global warming in a generation.
Republican Senator John Barrasso questioned the validity of global warming altogether. He also accused the Obama administration of suppressing scientific evidence. He cited a July 3, 2009 Wall Street Journal article on allegations of suppression of an EPA economist who questioned the science of global warming.
A culture of intimidation has no justification in any administration. This administration has publicly promised to hold itself to a standard of openness, transparency, and accepting of opinions from individuals with differing opinions. The administration has so far failed to make the grade.
Head of the EPA Lisa Jackson, Energy Secretary Stephen Chu, Interior Secretary Kenneth Salazar, and Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack all testified. Senator Boxer had one question for them all.
Just yes or no. Given the problem of global warming as you see it, and the opportunity for clean energy jobs, if we address it correctly, do you agree that this committee should do its job and move forward with a climate change, clean jobs bill?
Yes.
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 In addition, all those who testified said that cap and trade provisions should be part of the bill and that the U.S. can't afford to wait any longer to move forward. EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson.
Clean energy is to this decade and the next what the space race was to the 1950s and 60s, and America is behind.
Members of the Global Social Action Group of Oz.org came to the hearing wearing strongman muscle suits to symbolize that the bill needs to be strong. David Sievers is a coordinator with the group.
The rest of the world won't go along unless we, who have had the largest historic cause of global warming and are currently, you know, among the leading emitters, we've got to be part of the solution, and it's our obligation to take that first step because we've caused most of the problem.
After the hearing, the group dropped off barbells to senators' offices to remind them to pump up the energy bill. Karen Miller, FSRN, Washington.
And now a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Michael the Meal. Michael Jackson was many things in his 50 years of life. Child star, wunderkind, steering tenor, dancer extraordinaire, entertainer, even oddity. But he's more. In death, as in life, he has become a meal for the media. And the media is ever hungry and never full. I confess to sheer fascination, and thus perhaps I am feeding the very beast that I declaim, for fascination is fuel to the flame. Michael Jackson's entire life has been a source of fascination and has sparked the sales of newspapers, magazines, and assorted media outlets. CNN, the nation's premier cable news station, saw an increase of over 900%, 900% in viewership since Michael's passing. Don't you think the ever-growing profit motive has had something to do with this? For a brief, naive moment, I thought that the mad frenzy of the media for Jackson would dissipate with his passing. I could not be more wrong. We will hear, read, and see much more of Michael before this latest mania calms down. Driven by the lust for profits, the story will go on and on until nothing is left to eat. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Our newscast is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. Today's newscast was produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod K. Joes. Headlines editor Nell Abram, and the technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Puck Lowe and Oscar Hernandez. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda.